You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, welcome to the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is being broadcast on the 3rd of June, 2024. It's actually being recorded on the 3rd of June, 2024. And if you remember, I think it was 2 weeks ago, I did something on the Siege of Leningrad. And I promised a part two of that. And part two has to do with what happened over the next roughly 5 years from the war's end. Because apparently the siege didn't end. Now, of course, I tended to be a bit pro-German in this circumstance. But it was a few months ago, the 80th anniversary of the lifting of the siege was celebrated in what used to be called St. Petersburg. It was Petrograd, renamed to Leningrad after the revolution. And it's a very odd circumstance because people, those who led the city in the 4 years of the siege, 3.5 years of the siege, were showered with decorations and medals from Stalin, and within a couple of years were being arrested by him. Stalin officially designated Leningrad and Stalingrad, Sevastopol, Odessa, as heroic cities, officially. But at least as far as Leningrad is concerned, short time later, these men are arrested and some of them even executed. This is called either the Leningrad Purge or the Leningrad Affair. And it is mysterious and it's not well studied, although that has changed recently. And I came across a book called The Leningrad Affair, Soviets Against Russians. And it's written by Vladimir Kuznetsovsky. In 2013, there has been a recent, but also over the last decade, flurry of documentaries and books in Russian on this very strange matter. This book I want to talk about today is only in Russian, as far as I know. But let me give you an indication of why this is such a bizarre situation. Someone who was actually there, Daniel Granin, is cited early on in the book, and he's quoted as saying this: "The so-called Leningrad Affair is one of the most incomprehensible events to me. All those who were convicted were outspoken Stalinists. None of them ever showed opposition sentiments. They were all Stalin's promoters. No clear accusations were brought against them. The press reported nothing about the disclosure of this conspiracy or about the guilt or crime to the participants. Everything happened in total silence, which had not been the case before. Those who were herded, as Kuznetsovsky says, in Leningrad to the so-called open trials in the House of Officers were warned about non-disclosure. None of them opened their mouths until the deaths of the Secretary General, that is to say, Stalin himself. The veil of secrecy was so thick that even major security people, like P.A. Sudoplatov, admitted 50 years later in his memoirs, he said, the Leningrad Affair remained a secret even after Stalin's death, and even I, though I was the head of an independent service of the MGB, did not know about the fate of those who died in obscurity. The author writes, after Stalin's death, under Khrushchev pressure, those who directly carried out the investigative actions against the Leningraders, Viktor Abakumov, and those subordinate to him, were also shot. Malenkov and Khrushchev made great efforts to destroy the documents concerning their role in the destruction of the Leningrad group. It was September 30th, 1950. The accused were sentenced to death. And these men were, these were all major figures in Leningrad party affairs. As Gudanin said, these were all committed communists. They were all committed Stalinists. The chairman of the planning committee, Nikolai Vosensky, the chairman or the secretary of the central committee, Kunetsov, Alexei Kunetsov, the chairman of the council of ministers, Mikhail Rodionov, the first secretary of the Leningrad regional committee, Peter Popkov, and his deputy, Yakov Kapustin, and the chairman of the Leningrad executive, or the urban executive, Peter Lazutin. All of them were part of the resistance of Leningrad to the German siege from 1941 to 1944, were given medals up and down, and now, a few years later, are called subversives in the party apparatus, or of the party apparatus. They were shot about an hour after their verdict was announced, despite the fact that the death penalty had been abolished in 1947. So what the hell is going on here? And there's no doubt that this is the least known of all of Stalin's purges, and it deserves an independent treatment. So during the investigation, six of those arrested were tortured to death during their interrogation. Keep in mind, the men I just read to you, they were the leaders. There were many others, many of whom we don't really know, who were at least, maybe not executed, but removed from the party. Even Nikolai Solovyov, who during the war years, he was the chairman of the Leningrad Regional Executive Committee, who created the entire logistics system of the Leningrad Front. In fact, he was one of the organizers of the famous Road of Life on Lake Ladoga. And then since 1946, the first secretary of the Crimean Regional Committee of the Communist Party was beaten to death on orders from Lavrenti Beria, in the presence, in fact, of Malenkov. Now, the official reasons much later, or in the memoirs of those involved that came out much later, the official reasons for this purge are equally strange. First of all, election fraud, which, you know, then personal enrichment, and that included selling surplus product on the market without telling federal officials. But even if these things were even vaguely true, they were fairly minor offenses. They don't lead to a full-scale purge and executions. Now, I probably don't have to tell you that in 1954, those convicted, regardless of their punishment, the Leningrad case, were rehabilitated, and the charges brought against them were recognized officially as completely fictitious. Now, who they blamed is something also that you should probably dismiss. They blame a very odd, everything about this is odd, a very odd and somewhat obscure figure, despite his title. I've mentioned him already, the then Minister of State Security, Viktor Abakumov, who was purged for Zionism a year later. He was purged for being opposed to Beria at first, and then accused of being a supporter of his and his crimes a bit later, which is typical in Soviet, you know, legal, whatever they have on hand. Zionism wasn't technically a crime, but it was, you know, loyalty to, by this point, by the end of the 50s, what the Soviets considered an American extension. It had nothing to do with Judaism as such. Jews were in ruling positions all over the USSR. But loyalty of certain Soviet Jews was a problem for everybody, not just in communist countries. So we're talking about not just those purged, but those running the investigation. All party members, all connected with the city. After the war, I mean, you know, one of the interesting things is that these were fairly young men who were promoted rapidly after the war, although from the Soviet point of view, that made sense. But arrests were made all over the country, not just in that city. So clearly, these official charges don't make any sense. People were arrested in Moscow, Gorky, Murmansk, Novgorod, Ryazan, Pskov. So clearly, it wasn't just about Leningrad. The official numbers, the Minister of Internal Affairs at the time, Sergei Kruglov, and his deputy, Ivan Sirov, wrote a memo where they gave their numbers. They said 214 people were convicted, of which 69 were in that main central group of the accused, and 145 were either close or distant relatives. They say two people died in prison before trial, 26 were sentenced by the military commission for capital punishment. But in the book we're talking about here, the purge went roughly from 1949 to 1952, and over 2,000 people were at least fired from work or expelled from the party, or both. And that's just in and around the city of Leningrad itself. Family members were affected. That means the real numbers are much higher than the official ones. So you had major people, but they all had one thing in common. I'm going to get to that in a second. The Italian historian Giuseppe Boffa, I think I mentioned this already, that he noted that those affected, at least in Leningrad, the leadership, Kuznetsov, Rodion, they were young men and received very important promotions, appointments, rapidly in the 1940s for very obvious reasons. They were fairly powerful locally before the war, but clearly they were growing in power. And the one thing that these thousands here had in common is that they were all ethnic Russians. Now, I want to quote Kuznetsovsky, the author that we're dealing with here. We're going to deal with a lot of authors, but he is the main one from his 2013 book, and he's talking about the scale of this purge. Of course, now he has access to documents that they didn't have years ago. But his thesis is that this was a purely ethnic concern more than anything else. And I agree with him. Here's what he says. Trials, moral and political reprisals against ethnic Russian leaders in the Leningrad affair continued throughout the country until Stalin's death. In Leningrad, more than 50 people who worked as secretaries of district party committees and chairmen of district executive committees were sentenced to long prison terms. Over 2,000 people were expelled from the party. As follows from the archival material stored in the archives of the Russian Federation, thousands of senior officials were purged, Novgorod, Yaroslav, Murmansk, Saratov, etc. Not to mention the Crimea and Ukraine, as well as the Central Asian republics. More than 2,000 military commanders throughout the country were relieved of their positions and or demoted. So according to later estimates in the USSR, but mainly in Russia itself, the RSFSR, which was the common abbreviation for the Russian Soviet Federative Socialist Republic, more than 32,000 ethnic Russian leaders of the party, state, and the economy were subjected to one form of repression or another. So clearly, the archives have the number far higher than what anyone known up until 2013. Every one of these people was an ethnic Russian. The handful that might not have been were closely aligned with this movement. The agenda here was to destroy Russian involvement in the USSR. One of the many things that both capitalism and Marxism have in common is their hatred of nationalism and ethnicity, or politicized ethnicity. Well, with an exception here and there. As always, nationalism was the single greatest enemy of the Soviet Union. Of course, in the Russian case, that's a religious nationalism. The end of the war made this clear to Stalin and his ruling clique. There's a draft appeal, the Politburo, to members of the Central Committee by Malenkov and Beria. It says this, and this is actually their appeal. So Beria is writing this. In the enemy group of Kuznetsov, the question of the need to create an RCPB, that is to say, the Russian Communist Party Bolshevik, and the Central Committee of the RCPB, and about the transfer of the capital of the RSFSR from Moscow to Leningrad, Kuznetsov and others motivated these measures among themselves with slanderous arguments that the Central Committee of the All-Union Communist Party of Bolsheviks and the Union government were pursuing an anti-Russian policy and carrying out protectionism in relation to other national republics at the expense of the Russian people. So this document that Kuznetsovsky had unearthed prove that ethnicity, that is to say, the war against the Russian ethnicity, was what was motivating these purges. There's a chapter in his book called The Technology of Crime. And I want to quote, I have a lot of quotes here, but it's very important to note this. And of course, my translations are never very good, so give me a break. So the chapter, Technology of Crime, says, the MGB wiretapping carried out by order of Abakumov, which recorded a conversation with Popkov in Rodionov, in the apartment of the secretary of the Central Committee, Kuznetsov, about the disastrous economic, in comparison with other Union republics, position of Russia and the desire of these three to create a Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Russian Socialist Federative Republic. And from that moment on, Abakumov made it a rule to record all conversations between Kuznetsov and Rodionov and put all these notes on the leader's table. That's to say, Stalin's desk. Now, the recordings themselves were either destroyed or hidden. Even when these men were rehabilitated in the Khrushchev era, so many of the documents were shredded anyway. It was in 1944, early 1944, the secretary of the Leningrad City Executive Committee. And by the way, all these, you know, party titles and political titles are like that and go on and on. Bubnov, together with one of the so-called Leningraders, Popkov, signed a decision to return at least 20 streets and squares and to their historical pre-revolutionary names, including, Yuritsky Palace Square, which was its original name. And they changed one street, October 25th Avenue, obviously after the historic, after the October Revolution, they changed it back to Nevsky Avenue. So the author here says, over the years, my conviction grew stronger. It's impossible to understand the Leningrad case on its merits without its connection with the history of the development of the so-called Russian question over the entire period of the existence of Soviet Russia from 1917 to the present day. And in fact, the book's introduction has a quote from Molotov, dated 1980. And he says, the Communist Party was never able to resolve the Russian question. That is, what should be the status of the Russian Soviet Republic and the Russian nation within the USSR. And that's the core of the problem. Many people believe, and I want to say probably the overwhelming majority of professional historians in academia believe that the Russian Republic, the Soviet Republic, Socialist Republic, was dominant in the USSR. But that only became true during the war, and Stalin wanted to rectify that. It reminds me a little bit of England within Great Britain, or the so-called UK. Despite its large size, it didn't have its own political leadership. It didn't have its own party, or structures really of any kind, like all the republics had. It was weakened by a huge number of autonomous regions within it. That's something like 30 of them. But Russia had to be crushed in the former prison of nations, as the communists always called it, in the creation of the new Soviet man. It had to be exploited to bring the other republics to its economic and financial level, giving rise to numerous problems, often not making it out of the USSR to Western audiences. Those who wanted a strong Russian ethnic presence, at least according to the ruling class at the time, were, after the war, informally called Leningraders, which was not a term of praise, and it denoted a faction within the USSR that Stalin and Beria wanted out of the way. Now, how true is it? Well, the author here uses a few authorities, and this may be a little bit quote-heavy, but it's important to understand just the position of Russia within the Soviet Union throughout, especially after World War II. There's a lengthy report from Chebotareva called Russia, Donor or Metropolis. There was also a series of speeches in 1990 by Ivan Silyev, who died just last year, actually, who had been the chairman of the Russian government. And let me quote from the Russia Donor or Metropolis article here. The level of development of the productive forces of national regions was so low that some republics at the first stage of reconstruction didn't even have their own budget. It had to be created in the process if industrialization carried out exclusively at the expense of the Russian budget, the Russian Socialist Republic's budget. In 1925, the share of our, let me translate it differently. In 1925, the share of our own income in the budget of the Tajik SSR was 8%, Turkmen SSR 10, Ukrainian SSR less than 40. And an early leader from Georgia said, Soviet Russia replenishing our budget gives us 24 million rubles a year in gold. And we, of course, don't pay her any interest for this. Armenia, for example, is being revived not at the expense of the peasants, but at the expense of Soviet Russia. In Kazakhstan in 1923 and 1924, the share of subsidies amounted to 44% of the republic's budget. So you have places like the Tajik budget, 8% was directly from Russia. Transcaucasia, 36% comes directly from Russia as a subsidy. And that's a percentage of their yearly budget, which Russia had to write for them, that came directly from Russia. And yet the Soviet system was able to maintain a tremendous amount of control over this issue. You didn't have that in Yugoslavia, for example, where the ethnic question was always a huge problem. Russia was also forced to supply the outlying republics with qualified personnel. So, for example, prior to Gorbachev, 10%, that is to say the Russian population in Tajikistan, produced more than 50% of domestic national product. This shouldn't surprise anybody, and there was always a lot of resentment of Russian communities all over the now independent republics that are still producing a huge amount of the of these newly independent states' GDP. So let me quote Silyev here in one of these. Now, he was one of the bad guys because he was with Yeltsin early on. Well, at least partially because Yeltsin was the, you know, the president of Russia. But he also was a part of the failed, you know, liberalization. We all know what happened there. But let me quote him early on. He says, first of all, it turned out that Russia was the most economically oppressed republic. It was a gigantic donor. The total cost here usually amounted to something like 45 to 50 billion rubles. And this, in turn, is a quarter of the all-union budget, or a third of all the money that Russia earned. For us, this discovery was a real shock. When the USSR budget for 1991 began to be formed, I made a proposal on behalf of the Russian government to reduce the scale of assistance and to make it a targeted form of assistance. For this purpose, to create a fund in the amount of 15 billion rubles, of which Russia's contribution should be 10 billion. We also proposed every republic that receives subsidies should know from whom it takes it. Many simply didn't accept these ideas of the Congress of People's Deputies of the USSR. However, we stuck to our line because we believe that Russia should acquire all the attributes of actual statehood. The protection of our financial system caused a negative reaction from the leaders of the subsidized republics. I've talked on this show many times about how almost right up to the beginning of the war, Russia was continuing the subsidy of oil and gas to Ukraine. But this was the heart of the Russia question. Now, here you have a highly placed bureaucrat, an ally of Yeltsin early on. Clearly, he's talking about the very end of the USSR. But this man, shocked to learn in the late 80s, maybe very early 1990s, of how much Russia was milked for everyone else. And there was a reason that Russia really didn't have its own institutions up until the 1990s. And keep in mind, these technicians and scientists that were sent all over the outskirts of the USSR would have been working in Russia normally. Many of these transfers were not voluntary. But this is what people like Kuznetsov, Vozhensky, Rodionov, that's what these men were talking about. Because this had been going on practically from the very beginning. And it was becoming more and more obvious after the war. And it outraged them. And it's bizarre how long it took for anything serious to have been written on this. Where the other purges, of course, had plenty of attention all over the place. There's a woman, Galina Litvinova, who died in 1992. She was at the Institute of State and Law, the Russian Academy of Sciences, and she was one of the first to have access to the State Planning Committee statistics, also from the State Statistics Committee, and she conducted what's probably the most thorough analysis of the exploitation of Russia relative to the regions, national republics of the USSR. Now, up until the fall of the Soviet Union, she wasn't allowed to publish anything on this question. Clearly, this was a huge threat, and initially her report was just in typewritten copies. It was circulated hand to hand and by word of mouth. Now, of course, you get all her stuff on the web. But that article that eventually became a public, you know, she died in 1992, so she didn't have much time, you know, in the post-Soviet world. But in 1986, and we're talking about the early Gorbachev era, she wrote on the question of national policy. Again, these are all, for the very first time, these statistics have finally been discovered. Let me quote her this way. The situation of the main people of the Soviet Union, that is Russia, causes well-founded alarm and concern. Official statistics testify to the difficult humiliation, that position of the Russian nation in the most important spheres of the social, economic, cultural, and political life of the entire country. The prospect for the development of the USSR as a single multinational state require the strictest adherence to the constitutional principle of equality of nations. The benefits, the advantage previously provided to individual nations to ensure their rapid development made it possible to solve, in a very short time, the most important task in the field of national relations, the task of actual equality. With this decision, mainly by the end of the 1930s, the need for these benefits disappeared. Their continued preservation began to threaten the creation of new, actual inequalities. It seems advisable to make changes to budget and tax policies, as well as purchase price policies, etc., as a result of which, for decades, preferential conditions were created for the rapid pace of socioeconomic development of previously backward nations within the framework of the corresponding national states. Thus, in the 1950s, the incomes of collective farmers in the Uzbek SSR were 9 times higher than in Russia, and the cost of the gross harvest of crop products for one workday at purchase prices in the non-black earth zone were estimated 10 times lower in the Uzbek SSR and 15 times lower than in the Georgian SSR. Now, that's a lengthy quote, but it was very dangerous for her to bring this up. The secrecy on this question had been taken very seriously, and that would explain the extreme levels of secrecy that I mentioned at the beginning here concerning the trial of the Leningraders in the purge. Now, according to the census of 1970, the employed Russian population with specialists that had a higher education, rural and urban, turned out to be 1.5 to 3 times lower in Russia than that of the peoples of Central Asia, Kazakhstan, also Central Asia, and Transcaucasia. Russians found themselves in last place among nations with union republics, despite the fact that the largest universities in Russia give up to 25% of their places for non-competitive enrollment for representatives of previously backward, now advanced peoples. And that's what she was talking about when she meant actual inequalities. So the Soviets had affirmative action long before anybody else. You notice it's non-competitive enrollment. I made a point, and the author makes a point to bring that out. 1973, as a result of these, only a few people really had access to these particular issues. People knew something was wrong, but they couldn't quite put their finger on it because they didn't have access to the information. So among scientists functioning in the USSR by 1973, Russians and Belarusians had the lowest number of those qualified. They had the lowest percentage of the population with advanced degrees. Postgraduate students per 100 workers in science, or scientists, Russia had about 10 out of every 100 postgraduate students in the sciences. Belarusians had 13.4, Turkmenistan 26.2, and the Kyrgyz had almost 24 students per 100. In postgraduate institutions, in any republic, with the exception of the Russian, in the schools, young people learn the history of the USSR and the history of their native republic, whatever it might be. The only place that wasn't the case was in Russian schools. They only were taught the history of the USSR. Russia simply wasn't relevant. I'm going to quote her again. The population of the Central Asian republics, which recently was more than 10 times smaller than Russia, today maintains this gap only among pensioners, while the number of children and adolescents differs only by 2.8 times. And all these huge changes took place within the lifetime of one generation. Throughout Soviet history, the Russian people played a decisive role in carrying out socialist transformations, in the development of the industrial working class, in the production of material goods, in the formation of the all-union budget, in the solution of military strategic problems, and the development of science and art. The depopulation and degradation of this people is incompatible with the social, scientific, and technological progress of the entire Soviet state as a whole, and without solving the Russian question, perestroika is doomed to failure. Remember, she wrote this in 1986. And then you have Alexei Chichkin, who was on the state planning committee in the 1980s. So you can't really argue with the guy. He had very privileged access to extensive data in this regard. And his basic conclusion is the Kremlin developed a long-term policy of building up national republics at the expense of Russia and the Russian population. In terms of access to gas, I translated this as gasification. Up to 80% of the volume of Soviet oil and gas exports was provided by the Russian Socialist Republic. Baltic villages were way ahead of the Russian ones in terms of access to gas. Now I'm quoting him here. By the time the Baltic states left the Union, almost all villages of the Baltic states, as well as Western Ukraine and the Transcaucasus, were powered by gas. But in Russia today, thousands of villages, even near Moscow, were waiting to have access to gas. In other words, the policy was deliberately have certain Russian villages, even close to Moscow, living in third world condition. He also says, and this is very striking, he says from the 1950s to the 1980s, the level of wages and social benefits in general in most Union republics was about 30 to 45% higher than in Russia. But retail prices in the Russian Socialist Republic was higher by 20 or sometimes even 40%, depending on what good you're talking about, in comparison with the rest. So Russia had the lowest wages and the highest cost of living. But this was deliberate. Let me quote him again in this regard. Regarding the saturation of the USSR with consumer imports, so obviously you're talking about late in Soviet life, the corresponding decisions of the Politburo of the CPSU, Central Committee, and the Presidium of the Soviet Council of Ministers in 1959, 1963, 1978, and 1983 provided for a strict priority ranking. Imports of consumer goods should be directed primarily to non-Slavic Union republics and Western Ukraine, then to Belarus, then to the rest of Ukraine, then to the many autonomous republics of the Russian Socialist Republic, and then to the North Caucasus, and then from there to the national autonomous regions and districts of Russia itself. Exactly in this mentioned sequence, and only after all of this, according to their residual principle, then it comes to Russia and the Russian territory. This was how the Soviets fought separatism. You didn't have the harsh levels of collectivization in the non-Slavic republics. You didn't have the levels of anti-religious persecution, the elimination of the peasantry. And it was said, and the old slogan was, Russians will endure anything, so we can do as we please. There was an Aziri, someone from Azerbaijan, Sabit Aruyev, who was the minister of oil and gas extraction, that industry. And he was confronted by two economists, Kachuruov and Nekrasov. And they wrote a joint letter to him, and this is in 1977. And they say to him, over the last decade, the Russian Republic has been constantly disadvantaged in the allocation of various centralized resources. An increasing volume of them is allocated to the other republics, although control over the use of allocated resources in those republics is weakening and becoming just formal. Moreover, even what is allocated for Russia is very often withdrawn from its own funds. There's an unfavorable trend of freezing not only capital investments, but various natural resources on the territory of the Russian Socialist Republic, while an increasing volume of both, respectively, is directed and developed to the others. The latter require an increase both capital investments and supplies through import lines, that is, limits, which, unlike most of the same requests from the Russian Socialist Republic, is satisfied. The continuation of this situation will entail irreversible imbalances in the socioeconomic development and resource provision of the regions throughout the USSR. Now, that's a very clumsy translation of mine, but I think it's very clear what's happening. Especially, and the fact that this has been going on in the 30s. This has been going on, you know, from the early part of Stalin's era to these letters and to these protests. There was usually no official response. But there was a discrimination against those, especially of Russian background, who would even bring this up. An article in 2017, the author Alexander Zapolsky wrote an article called "Who Fed Whom in the USSR? And Who Lost More from Its Collapse?" Again, some of these statistics have been released to the public for the first time ever in articles like this. And it was very clear, and there's no one who disagrees who's, you know, I've been citing here, that these numbers were actively suppressed purely for ideological motives. Now, the metric that he uses in that article is per capita production versus per capita consumption. And he uses 1990 figures measured in thousands of dollars. So, for example, in Russia, Russia produced per capita $17,500 worth of goods and consumed only about $12,000. So they're producing more than they're consuming, but you don't see this anywhere else. Ukraine was even, $12,400 versus $13,300. They were consuming slightly more than they were producing. But you get to Armenia, where they're producing $10,000 worth of goods per capita, and we're consuming $30,500. Georgia, producing $10,000 and consuming $41,900, $1990 worth of things. In other words, Georgia then lived, what, almost four times better than the Russians. And because of that very simple ratio, lived better than pretty much anyone else. This is the result of these subsidies. This is why Russia didn't have its own institutions. It even came, and there was a whole bunch of authors who, after the fall of the USSR, talked about the deliberate attempt to depict within the Soviet press Russians, ethnic Russians, as lazy and always drunk. In fact, in this article, Zapolsky mentions it. No one, not one person, refuted the figures that he published. And this is just within the USSR, let alone the billions that were transferred from the Russian budget to socialist countries, everywhere from Cuba to Nicaragua to the Warsaw Pact. As of right now, well, I shouldn't say right now, as of 2017, those numbers have not been, they're still secrets, at least in the party archives. Clearly, now, this is not off topic. This is what the purge of the so-called Leningraders were all about. Even after the war, it was pretty obvious that even if, you know, you're as anti-communist as I am, and you are, it was a tremendously heroic thing to resist that siege in the Second World War. It should never have happened. It was not the fault of the Germans. We talked about that at great length. But the so-called Russia issue, some of these guys, the reason why they were called Leningraders, rose to prominence because it was pretty clear, especially now, that it was their ethnic solidarity that kept there from being any food riots, that kept there being any there wasn't much fraud, especially under, you know, emergency conditions, and it's remarkable. Mikhail Solomentsev, considered a statesman of the Communist Party, brought this up directly to Leonid Brezhnev, who, of course, was Ukrainian. The only Russian leader of the USSR was Gorbachev. Brezhnev was Ukrainian. Obviously, Chernenko. Andropov was Jewish. Stalin was Georgian. Lenin, obviously. So the only Russian head of the USSR didn't come around. I mean, Brezhnev had an accent, even though he was from Kharkov. But this is now 20 years after the arrests and purges, the Leningrad affair. Brezhnev appointed Solomentsev to the post of the chairman of the Council of Ministers in the Russian Federation in 1971, or the Russian Socialist Republic in 1971. And he agreed to this on one condition, and his one condition is stop shutting Russia down. He knew Russian industry very well throughout the entire country. And Brezhnev asked, what does it mean to shut it down? What are you talking about? Well, in response, he said he was just on a trip to Bryansk, and he had visited a village that still lived in dugouts since the war. This is 1971. Then he directly said to Brezhnev, he said, these departments, these sectoral departments of the Central Committee and the Union government directly command Russian regions and specific enterprises, guided more by the interest of the Union republics, leaving Russia only crumbs from the oil union table. Which was a ballsy thing to say, A, because it's Brezhnev, and B, because Brezhnev was Ukrainian. And Western Ukraine, he was not from Western Ukraine, but Western Ukraine was certainly more privileged than Eastern Ukraine in this regard. I don't mean to say that, you know, this is very different. The rest of Ukraine, Western and Eastern, was really a part of policy as culture or anything else. So, there were those in this era, or earlier, or anywhere, the post-war world, let me put it that way, eager to come up with a proposal. Mikhail Rodionov. A proposal to create a bureau of the Central Committee of the All Union Communist Party for the Russian Republic, which was considered almost a treasonous, albeit revolutionary, idea. Yes, it did exist for a very short time, from 1936 to 1937, but it had no power. They even wrote a note to Stalin, 1947, which is, and that note is reproduced in the book I'm talking about here. It was a certain naivete, because that note was sent to Stalin. It was dated September 27th, 1947. The purges started 2 years later. This is clearly not an accident. They were naive in the sense that they thought, given their significance in the war effort, given what Stalin was saying about them, the medals that they received, that they could talk like this. How could Stalin be against this, right? Stalin refused to respond to any of this stuff. Rodionov, one of the core people executed in the purge, wrote roughly a year later, 1948, what the author calls a detailed and fatal letter to Malenkov. It was classified for the entire history of the Soviet Union as top secret, and it ends with this, with these words. It ends by saying, in the Russian Soviet Republic, there is no Ministry of State Security. There is no Ministry of Internal Affairs. In fact, no Republican bodies really exist at all for Russia. Russia never had its own media during the Soviet era. All republics had their own press organs, controlled as they were. And it was very hard for the Soviet leadership to explain why only Russia didn't have its own. And in that letter, they said, I asked the Central Committee of the All-Union Communist Party of Bolsheviks to consider the issue of creating a bureau of the Central Committee of the All-Union Communist Party of Bolsheviks for the Russian Socialist Republic. Going back to Solomentsev, and chairman of the Council of Ministers, we talked about him confronting Brezhnev, retiring only in 1983. He wrote, some wise men who have not experienced firsthand the peculiarities of state and public administration asked, why does Russia need a Republican ministry, media, public organization? The Central Committee, the CPSU, allied organizations, ministries, and departments are directly involved in Russia. It is supposedly in a more advantageous position than the other republics. It was rumored that with such a special position, she received from the Union State a larger piece of the pie than others. Believe me, a man who's worked at all levels of engineering, economic, party, and state power, that such an opinion is of the greatest illusions, the fruit of thoughtlessness and ignorance on the true state of affairs. I don't rule out that this is a feeling of jealousy or maybe just rancor and anger. Obviously, some documents from this era remain, although many were destroyed. It doesn't mean a coherent picture can't be drawn up. People like Rodionov actually believe that he could change this, that this was somehow an oversight, referring to the family of Union Republics and other such slogans. In fact, he even went to Shostakovich, the famous composer, to create a new anthem just for Russia, but of course, none of this was to be. You know, as I said in the beginning, these were all hardcore Stalinists. But they also, I don't want to call them Russian nationalists, but they simply made the claim that Russia is the center of this. Russia would be the center of any empire. So we're dealing here with a group of men, people like Alexei Kunetsov, the soul of defense of Leningrad, he was called. After the war, he was transferred to Moscow, became secretary of the Central Committee for Personnel. If you remember, I briefly talked about that a couple weeks ago. In fact, he was even entrusted with overseeing the security agencies, the prosecutor's office that Beria had controlled at one point. But we have to note that being cut off from the Red Army for a long time, having their own little world over there in Leningrad, they began to think for themselves. They began to develop ideas that we would call nationalists today. It's very obvious, and I have plenty of authority to say this, that the top leadership of the USSR, I'm not talking about Russia at all, top leadership of the USSR was very sensitive to the authority of this bunch of guys. They were the heroes of the USSR, every last one, an ethnic Russian. The siege of Leningrad, unlike, you know, Stalingrad, of course, gets all the attention in the West. But after the war in the Soviet Union, the siege of Leningrad was a huge area of concern and just praise upon praise upon praise from Stalin himself. But there's a problem. For any dictator, any of the Soviet dictators, these alternative centers of authority, in this case, it's not power, it's authority, caused someone like Stalin a great degree of many sleepless nights. The Leningraders earned a tremendous amount of authority during the war, and their popularity as men overshadowed the leaders in Moscow. And Stalin, I don't have to tell you, wasn't big on political competition. That's why I have to laugh at the official election fraud accusation. Like, that's even relevant. It's almost like they were mentioning it to be funny. But what began to happen is some of these guys got a little louder than they should have, thinking that, you know, Stalin has just given us medals and positions and put us in sensitive positions. We've earned the right to talk about this issue. If anyone has earned it, we have. That they weren't as secretive as they used to be. And I mentioned the one of the security guys recording them. They were simply naive. And Beria, you know, who was allegedly in charge of an artillery battery, which I wonder, during the war, came to really hate these guys. They were independent. And actually, they became even more independent than that. We'll talk about here in a minute. Beria, even after the war, said some of these guys were agents of British intelligence. And even Stalin, you know, told Beria to shut it after a while. But anyone Beria didn't like, he kind of threw in with these Leningraders. You know, some of these guys early on made Beria, for whatever reason, hated even, you know, more than Stalin. And Beria was the one who kind of translated what was going on in Leningrad to Stalin and giving it the worst possible, you know, the worst possible coloring. And of course, he is Jewish. Saying things like about Leningrad, and Kunetsov, in fact, said, "Leningrad is a city that has eclipsed the glory of Troy. We must achieve the situation that new cadres of people of science, party, and Soviet leaders come out from Leningrad throughout the entire country. And these men were actively promoted, 46, 47, 48. After the executions, of course in secret, people were sent out from the center to keep the so-called spirit of Leningrad from ever developing again. It wasn't directly stated, at least not in any public body, but everyone understood the essence of the matter. The purges, we talked about the thousands of people, continued at least until the middle, if not the end, of 1951. Those 2 years, just in that region, 814 leaders, well, about 63% members of the regional committee, nomenklatura, were ultimately replaced. In 1950, 2,280 people were replaced. People were worried not just about if they didn't serve the Soviet, if they were showed cowardice or whatever on the battlefield. They started now to worry that they showed too much enthusiasm, especially if they were Russian. Anyone who was called a Leningrader, it didn't matter what city you were from, Leningrader meant Russian nationalist, was removed. There was a massive purge of ethnic Russians. In Gorky, Crimea, everywhere, even the Karelia, Finnish Republic, Estonia. The most ridiculous demagoguery was laid out. And of course, the secrecy was extraordinary here, and friends were able to freely betray one another. This was a merciless purge. It was an ethnic one. They were cleaning out Russians. It had nothing to do, after all, I mean, it started in Leningrad, but it really had nothing to do with the city. It was about Russians in general. I mentioned Nikolai Voznesensky, who, you know, probably the best known of all of them. He knew Kosygin. He was understood as, you know, a brilliant man. Losing him was an incredibly stupid thing. Mikoyan said he had very few shortcomings. But he also said that he was a chauvinist, a Russian chauvinist, that Georgians and Armenians and Ukrainians aren't people, which is a stupid thing to say. And it was stuff like this that created the environment where Russian nationalists came up against the internationalists. So anyone wants to talk about the campaign against cosmopolitanism, which is not what that was about. Here you have Stalin and Beria creating the international, the internationalist faction to destroy Russian nationalists. Now, it gets complicated with other people, especially Ukrainians. And Ukrainians kind of make sense as the second most substantial and productive group of people in the USSR. There was no one, however, to protect the Russians. Every other ethnic group had a leader that knew somebody, was part of the bureaucracy, such that they could protect their own. And in Ukraine, we've actually spoken about that many years ago. But even Stalin's book, The Economic Problems of Socialism, it comes up. And some of these men were involved in its composition. But there was a draft party program from the so-called Zhdanov group, which was another term for Leningrad. And there's even some people who, you know, say that Leningrad even had itself, you know, Khrushchev, Malenko, Beria were not the main figures in this affair, but they used it for their own purposes. I don't agree at all, at least in Beria's case. Even that, if you look at the number, there's allegedly self enrichment with public funds. The numbers are not very high. It's almost funny. Now, maybe it's not going to shock anyone that one of the leaders against the Leningraders was Kaganovich. Vinogradov, in fact, mentions it in his own writings on the topic. So there's no doubt in my mind that there's not just, it's a cosmopolitan movement backed by Stalin and Beria, and a Jewish movement. Beria, of course, was Jewish, although eccentric, to purge anything that would harm their positions of power. As I said, April 30th, 1954, the Leningrad case was completely dismissed as fraudulent and everything else. But you did have them. Remember, this is a bit before Khrushchev, but the organizers were Malenkov and Khrushchev, who considered this a very shameful thing to do. But they did also destroy documents. They were trying to hide their own participation, and not just this purge, but many others. Khrushchev mentioned something along these lines after his retirement. It was published in 1968. And he says, Beria could have organized this in a different way. Malenkov planted materials along the party line, and Abakumov planted materials on the KGB line. The source of all versions was Beria, an intelligent man, a resourceful organizer. He had to not only remove Vozinensky from the Council of Ministers, and was afraid that Stalin might return him there, and Beria pursued the goal of destroying Vozinensky, finally dumping him and burying him so that a return to public life for him would not take place. The head of the State Planning Committee, Nikolai Bybakov, in his memoirs, he mentions, he has a whole chapter about Beria, and he says, in the entire leadership of the country, he was the only one who decided to misinform the leader, shuffle the facts in front of him, arranging them in a light favorable to himself, mainly in order to discredit people he disliked, potentially dangerous to his personal goals, and there were many of them, were those who did not want to please him or resisted his omnipotence. Among his unjustified cases is a reprisal against a prominent figure in our state, chairman of the USSR State Planning Committee, which lies on his conscience, and that's Vozinensky, as a possible successor to Stalin, of course, leader of the, or probably the best known of all the Leningraders. Vozinensky constantly clashed with Beria at meetings. He certainly didn't fear Beria. And there are those today, actually I think there were those at the time, that said Beria doesn't believe in anything. He's not a communist. He's not a nationalist of any kind. He craves only power for the sake of his own pleasure. The author we're talking about here also has another book from 2014 called Stalin, How It Was. And he writes in it, he says, more than 30 years of acquaintance with most of the literature about Stalin led me to a paradoxical conclusion. Everything that's been written about this man in Russia and abroad, everything is true, both negative and positive. An outstanding man, politician, expert, and follower of Machiavelli. One can only be amazed at Stalin's magnetism, charisma. Both the Leningraders idolized him, and the Minister of State Security, Abakumov, who led all the arrests and investigations, did everything the leader ordered, and then the leader himself handed him over. It isn't like Stalin wasn't praising the Russians. It was a toast to the Russian people right after the war. To honor the commanders of the Red Army, June 24, 1945, he said, I drink first of all to the health of the Russian nation, because they are the most outstanding nation of all the peoples that make up the Soviet Union. He then made a public apology to Russia, not anyone else, for the military defeats of 1941 and 1942, which these toasts said were his fault. The fault lay with him and his government. But this trust of the Russian people and the Soviet government turned out to be the decisive force which ensured a historic victory over the enemy of humanity, over fascism. And thank you to the Russian nation for this trust. So when I say these guys were naive, well, that might be true. But it wasn't like he wasn't saying things to encourage this. The victory in Leningrad, the victory over Army Group North, for better or for worse, went from heroes to criminals overnight over the stupidest of official charges. Malenkov and Beria, Malenkov, I should say, knew, and they probably, even though Stalin was very secretive, they knew what he was thinking about so-called Russian nationalism, and that the only real threat to the Soviet Union would come from this Leningrader ideology. Apparently no other nationalism could do it. I mean, Ukrainian maybe. He thought that the notion of Russia having its own party, its own media, would be extremely dangerous. And he was terrified of the popularization of this idea amongst Russians. Of course, making a mockery of the thesis that he was a nationalist. The author here comes down to saying, you know, if Russia had its own party and its own Republican institutions, then what the hell would Stalin's role be? Would he just be the leader of the rest of the republics? There is no Soviet Union without Russia. But they were a repressed, third-rate power, and I showed you all the statistics here. The Leningraders wanted to destroy the Soviet Union, and therefore the meaning of Stalin's whole existence. There is no, the USSR was impossible without the exploitation of Russians. As if the Soviet Union wasn't exploitative enough. And he was, according to a few people who were there, very preoccupied with what's going to happen to the USSR after he dies. And he was extremely worried about separatism. But even before that, but near his death, he clearly was absolutely obsessed with it. He also wrote another book called Stalin and the Russian Question, and which I haven't talked about yet, but it's the same author we've been talking about this whole time, Vladimir Kuznetsovsky. When I say the author, that's who I'm talking about. Who himself, of course, is a Russian nationalist. But he wrote Stalin and the Russian Question around this same time. And he discusses in a chapter, a dedicated chapter, that the Leningraders wanted to go a little further. They wanted to create what he calls a civilized social state, something different from the Bolshevik one. And it comes from their draft party program of 1947. I hinted at it. But what we have of that draft party program was something that was going to replace the Lenin-Stalin Soviet Bolshevik one. And it sounds an awful lot like a social nationalist and Eurasian state. Essentially, this was a manifesto of the Russians. It was classified under Stalin. It would be the end of the dictatorship of the proletariat. I don't know if there's an original copy anywhere. 4 pages. You know, it's a manifesto. It wasn't a whole book, of course. Saying that the core of the USSR is the Russian nation. And, of course, the party, being heavily Jewish and foreign, rejected it. But Beria's political lobbying after Stalin's death in early March of 1953, one of the things that Beria did was a mass amnesty, not of political prisoners, but of criminals, releasing them from prisons around the country. And Beria, he didn't last long afterwards, but he was heavily involved in Ukrainianization, Lithuanianization, terrified about the Russification of places like Belarus or Estonia. Right after Stalin's death, one of the first things that Beria did was to create this nationalization of the outlying republics, not Russia, of course. It was the politics, I think it was called the priority of the titular nation, which was Beria's nationality policy, that did have plenty of supporters in Moscow. The right of nations to self-determination, except for one. And early on, in Ukraine, Leonid Milinkov was removed. Kirichenko was put in his place. Pavel Mieshik also was a protege of Beria, making sure that all Central Committee meetings in Kiev were done in Ukrainian. He wanted the entire Ministry of Internal Affairs in Latvia, for example, to be turned over exclusively to Latvian nationalists, to transfer Russians, to remove them, which in and of itself is okay, but of course it's still at the expense of Russia. He wanted record keeping to be abolished if it's done in the Russian language in the Baltics. In Belarus, it's the same thing. Bringing in one of his proteges, Mikhail Zimianin, to replace the Russian Nikolai Patolichev, Secretary of the Central Committee. And it was approved just a couple of months after Stalin's death, June 12, 1953. Of course, that's also when Beria was arrested. And everything had been changed and reversed. But this is why I'm saying Beria was at the core of this, and hence the Jews and the internationalists that Stalin had surrounded himself with, or at least who knew how to manipulate Stalin. My God, Beria even wanted Zhukov to reorganize the army around ethnic units. And all of this, it wasn't because he was some nationalist. That's nonsense. This would all come at the expense of Russia, to keep Russia as a, however large it is, to keep Russia at a low economic level. Zhukov knew that Beria would have been the end of the Soviet army and the Soviet Union. But so long as Russia kept financing them, Beria went so far as to demand the Union Republic should separate, to create a new non-Russian and anti-Russian federation. Sergei Beria, his son, stated all of this, which I know is radical, but this is what's being published right now. This is extraordinary. We don't know much about the social nationalist program of the Leningraders. Of course, used nothing but Soviet Stalinist terminology. But Beria told Stalin that this was going to be the end. Little did Stalin know what Beria had in mind. But he seems to be the bad guy here. But let's face it, what is the Soviet Union? To use Gumilev's term, it is a chimera. It was something created by Lenin and Trotsky, along with the Western world, to destroy the Russian Empire. Beyond that, there really was no plan other than destruction. You still have otherwise intelligent Russian nationalists who somehow believe the Soviet Union should be restored, forgetting about what the Leningrad Affair was. There were no Russian politicians at the top of the Union government, except maybe Kosygin. The Ukrainians, Balts, Third Worlders dominated substantially. And the Ukrainians, especially under Brezhnev. Now, we're not talking about how heroic the Soviet Union was, but within that context, it was completely dependent on Russia, and yet there was nothing more that terrified the leadership of the USSR other than Russian nationalism, other than even a Eurasian nationalism, anything that smacked of orthodoxy and what being Russian really is. But of course, this anti-Russian policy was an utter disaster and is one of the reasons the Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore. Because without a strong Russian ethnic core, that federation could never have functioned for long. It was a complete disaster from 1949 to 1953. Russia and Russians within the Union suffered a total personnel disaster. The entire intellectual elite of the Russian nation was knocked out of any administration, any bureaucratic structure. Those like Zhdanov, who had advanced them in the first place, Beria knew what this meant. He was a Jew and thought like one as far as the cosmopolitans are concerned. And this is one of the reasons why the regime keeps talking about, you know, Stalin's anti-Semitism. Anyway, I know I've gone way over my time here. I thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.